History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a couple key steps. One, to ask a few questions, and two, just be willing to be patient enough to listen as memories from long ago rise to the surface again and take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's hard to think of anything that's gripped me more over the years than the stories from those who have had to live in the absence of freedom. They sure view the concept of freedom in a different light, and they help us develop a little different perspective as well. Did you know that the third Friday of September every year is National Prisoner of War and Missing in Action Day? And did you know that nearly 82,000 Americans are still unaccounted for from our wars overseas, with about half of those presumed lost at sea? And did you know that the efforts to locate and recover those heroes are still ongoing? We're going to have more about some of those efforts in a future episode, but I had the chance to attend a special POW MIA recognition this week, and I wanted to devote this weekend's episode to this issue and give you a feel for it through the memories of two men who survived captivity in World War II. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can find dozens of ex-POW stories, mostly from World War II, but a few from the Korean War as well. There are also still 1,579 Americans missing and unaccounted for from the Vietnam War, but significant progress has been made on that front in recent years. If you ever found yourself in the courtroom of a judge named M.W. Del Rey, and you happen to lodge a complaint, he might not have had a whole bunch of sympathy for you, given what he went through with the 379th Bomb Group as a B-17 navigator. He had actually been in the Navy Reserve before Pearl Harbor, but when America entered the war, the Navy rejected him because of albumin in his urine. The Army Air Corps was just fine with him, but the navigator role was actually something he requested after Uncle Sam thought of something else.
Well, I went back to Santa Ana, and you had to take this test again, multiple choice. There were three parts to it. Top grade was 9, and I got a couple of 8s and a 9. I know they called me in. The sergeant says, well, we're going to make a bombardier out of you. And I said, I don't want to be a bombardier. I want to be a navigator. And he said, well, you have to go see the major. So I went and see the major, and major looked at the record. He says, give him what he wants. If he wants to be a navigator, go ahead. I got back with the other guys and found out guys were getting 6s and 7s on that test. But I was, as I say, I knew how to take it. They didn't know how to take the test, and that's the reason I got high, and they didn't.
And why, in your mind, was it preferable to be a navigator as opposed to a bombardier?
I don't know. I want to be a navigator on B-17 and go to Europe. And that's what happened. I didn't want to get shut down. But I did. Anyway, I don't know why. I know a very good friend of mine from Tulare became a bombardier, and he was the only class of 1938 that I know of that was killed in the war, and he got killed over there looking for me. He said, oh, well, that's another story.
He wanted to go find you because he knew you were a prisoner? Is that what you're saying?
He told my folks when he left, he said he'd find me over there, but he didn't. He got shot down. And Jack Russell is his name, yeah. Very good friend of mine.
For you as this young man, and you said you wanted to go over in B-17s and fight this air war in Europe, did you have any idea what that actually meant and what you were actually going to be up against?
No, I didn't know. You didn't know. I knew it was going to be rough because we'd already heard a lot. I thought we knew what we were fighting for, but that was it, yeah.
So what was going through your mind as you headed overseas? You leave behind your family here in the States, not knowing if you're going to come back. What do you remember thinking and looking forward to or even dreading at the time?
I was young, remember? We're young guys. And we're not thinking about not coming back. Although I found out from, there were guys who were getting down about 10% getting shot down every time. And I said, at that rate, we can't make it. And the rest of my crew said, oh, yeah, we can make it. But you didn't think about that stuff. I didn't think about that. Now, some guys couldn't get to the airplane because they were scared to death. I don't know. I never got scared until we got started getting shot at. And then that's when I started getting scared. Yeah.
Well, that's understandable. For people who've never been on a B-17 or weren't alive then and don't know what it was like, tell us about being a navigator on that plane, where you sat, and what your duties were.
Well, in Europe, the navigator really wasn't that important. Lead navigator was, and you had to know where you were at all times, so in case you got shut out of the formation and then had to get home. But primarily, you were probably maybe a commissioned gunner. I had a 50 caliber machine gun on the left and none on the right, so... But we had to know where we were at all times, as I say, and other than that, why, it wasn't that difficult. If you go to the Pacific, then the navigator is really important.
But for you, if you're in formation, the lead navigator leading that flight has to be on target. Otherwise, you guys just trust him. And then, but if you get shot down, as you say, then you've got to adjust and plot a new course, perhaps, huh?
That's right. Of course, it's go west and you can get home.
And anybody that has driven down the 99, and that's millions and millions of people who have passed through Tulare on the 99, and hopefully they notice, if they're heading north, off to their right, a B-17 with a yellow triangle and a big black K in the middle of it. And most people say, hey, I wonder what that stands for. You actually know what that stands for.
Triangle K, yeah, it was the 379th at Kim Bolton, yeah.
That's the 379th Bomb Group, your bomb group. Kim Bolton, England, is where you flew your missions from.
That's right. It's about 20 miles north of Bedford.
When you got to Kim Bolton, and this is 1943, still pretty early in this air war for America and Europe, what was it like there? What did you find?
Kim Bolton's the size of about Tipton, if that's large enough. But a little place and just an airport. What was tough was like they'd want to check out pilots for night landings and they'd have to have a navigator on. And that was, we call them circuits and bounces. But that was an interesting little job.
Make you feel like a guinea pig a little bit?
Yeah, that was tough.
So tell me about your first mission. What do you remember about that? How anxious were you for that to happen?
The first mission, I believe it went over the Ruhr Valley. On the map, all the aircraft deals are in red. The Ruhr Valley is just a big red moon thing there. And when you hit that, it's before you hit it, you get hit by fighters. And then after you hit it, the fighters don't come in and you get you. And I hit that a couple of times, as I recall. And then... one time to run to Kiel, which is north, and we couldn't make it there because it was clouded over. That was when we turned back, and there's an island out in the North Sea called Helgoland, and on that island was German fighters, and they attacked us, and that's when my pilot took violent evasive action, and it was a little too violent and dropped way down, so wonder we didn't get shot down, because they usually hit guys that are out of formation, but we got back in all right.
That sounds a little exciting. Were you scared a little bit?
Yeah. I think we're always scared a little bit, yeah.
And when those fighters come at you, because of where you are, and you described having a 50 caliber to your left, a 50 caliber to your right, are you firing away trying to get a piece of these fighters?
I had one come through the formation right to my right. All I had to do was fire the gun, because he went right past us. But I thought, if I kill him, he might run into the guys behind us. Well, a couple of seconds, he's gone. Didn't even fire a shot. I hate to admit that. Mm-hmm. I did fire one down below us to the left and saw smoke come out and reported it, and they just laughed and said, forget it. You didn't get him. Anyway, I had one. We were flying in formation, being shot. Flak's coming. You can hear the flak on your, like somebody throwing rocks on the tin roof. And this one airplane broke off to the right out for a while. And it just happened. It was an accident, I know, because all of a sudden Flat came out there and he came right back into the formation. I don't know why. I don't know whether it was later I laughed about it, but I think I laughed about it right then. I was scared to death and still laughed at that guy. That was one of the few times something funny.
Yeah, I think that is an odd juxtaposition to be flying and Flak hitting your airplane and you could die at any moment and you're breaking out in laughter. That had to strike your crew funny.
You know, I'm not sure I did it then or it was later, but I know it struck me as being funny. To be honest, I really don't know if I laughed then or not, but I know it struck me funny at the time.
So you've had three missions and encountered pretty stiff opposition on all three of those first three missions?
Well, yeah. Well, the first two and the one to Kiel, got attacked by fighters. That wasn't that bad coming home. I couldn't say that was a bad mission. But the two or the Ruhr Valley, they were tough. I thought that was rough. And then, of course, my last mission was the one.
So this is your fourth mission. And you've got a different pilot than you had on your first mission.
Yeah, we got rid of Fred White and got Bidwell. Anyway, we took off on that mission. Well, that's the one where we got checked. We were being critiqued and navigation critiqued. And I checked the deal and said, well, we're going to get to the French coast 10 minutes early from what it says on this. And the navigation lieutenant there said, oh, don't worry about it.
So your calculations were a little different than theirs.
Yeah, well, I always thought, I never had been able to check, but it always seemed that we got there, we weaved a little bit back and forth and just take some time up so we could meet our...
Fighter escort?
Fighter escort.
Well, you know, it's really interesting you say that. The 8th Air Force has a database online that you can search and pulls up all kinds of records. I pulled up the official report on that mission that day to Le Bourget, France. It said, fighter escort accompanied us almost the entire route. 19 of our aircraft bombed the primary target, which was the airfield and depot at the Le Bourget, Paris, France, at 0932 today. The result of the bombing was considered by several of our crews to be good, and our lead bombardier saw his bombs land on the designated aiming point, from which subsequently there appeared voluminous red flames. 22 of our aircraft were airborne, but one of these was designated as a planned abortive, and he turned back to our base upon reaching the English coast. It was the opinion of some of our crew members, especially those in the high squadron, that the enemy fighter opposition was the most aggressive that they have met so far. On the other hand, they were surprised by the meagerness of the enemy flak over the target. For the most part, the friendly fighter support was effective and on time, but there was a lag of about 10 minutes between the leaving of one fighter group and the appearance of the succeeding fighter group at the IP. It was during this lag that the enemy made his most ferocious attack. Approximately 50 enemy aircraft were encountered. Enemy aircraft slipped in through P-47 formation and came in out of the sun. ME-109s pressed attacks to 75 to 100 yards. Attacks were made in groups of four. Attacks by enemy aircraft were made on the high squadron, did not follow through on other squadrons. And it continues. But when you talk about your calculations being 10 minutes different, and this official Air Force report saying a lag of about 10 minutes is what caused the casualties, it sounds to me that's exactly what happened to you.
Yeah, maybe, I guess so. We weren't the only plane shot down. I think there were two shot down that day out of our group.
So what do you remember happening? Did you start to feel something was wrong when you guys were delaying?
No, I know that we got attacked by fighters, but when we got to the bomb run, I got hit on the bomb run by flak on my arm and in my leg. I still think I have a little piece of flak left in my leg. We got through the bomb run, and then I noticed the whole group was apparently taking up and gaining altitude. And it suddenly dawned on me, the group wasn't gaining altitude. We were going down. It just looked that way. I looked back up through the Astrodome and could see the pilot and co-pilot fighting the plane up there. Well, I know then I got back down, and the bombardier's still up in the nose, and he's not working. Then I looked back down, and right next to my desk and back is the escape hatch. I look back there, and here's the pilot by the escape hatch on the other side of it, and on the catwalk right next to it is the engineer. And I get up there, and the pilot had tried to open the escape hatch against the slipstream, and it wouldn't open. I could look down, and there was, maybe 6 inches, I guess. I could look through it and see the ground coming up. It kept going. We made a couple of swings. We were in a spin going down. And at the bottom of every spin, I could see the ground. And finally, we hit the ground, I thought. And then I thought I could be thinking if I'm dead, you know. And I opened my eyes, oh, I'm falling. And so I pulled the ripcord, the chute opened, and sure enough, my arms and legs, the right leg just flopped. I saw something going. I saw the fuselage going in the ground and something else, I don't know what. Then I saw two ME-109s going about a couple hundred yards, maybe 300 yards, and going to miss me. Then they turned towards me for a little while, and then they turned back. Well, I found out later that the report was that the pilot was killed in his parachute. So I don't know whether they didn't see me or what, but they went on to him. Anyway, I finally landed and hit the ground. The bombardier ran up to me, so we must have pulled our chutes at the same time to be close, you know. Then a German fighter came in and started strafing us, and I told Rader, I said, Wayne Rader was my bombardier, I said, get out of here, he's trying to kill me. Not us, me. And, so, and anyway, Rader looked at him company, and he left. And many years later, I visited him in Oregon. Mm-hmm. I asked him about it. He said, I don't remember that. I was feeling so bad saying he'd been trying to kill me and not us, you know.
Thankfully, they both survived, but M.W. Del Rey would often wonder in the years that followed if he would have made it out alive without a blessing that may have seemed more like a curse at the time. The seemingly unfortunate way a German doctor handled his broken leg might have been the most fortunate twist of his life. We'll hear that part of the story when this special POW MIA Day edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode dedicated to National POW MIA Recognition Day, marked on the third Friday of September every year. Let's pick up ex-POW M.W. Del Rey's story back in 1943, shot down and wounded on his fourth B-17 mission. He would find out later that his pilot was shot in his parachute on his way down, but Del Rey made it safely to the ground. So what was the extent of your injuries?
My arm, upper arm, and my leg, upper leg and my lower leg were bleeding, and the German guards came in a pickup. Two ugly ones looked just like guys in the movie, and I'm laying there, and this one guy, they got guns, you know, on me, and this one guy says, pistola. I had a 45 under my shoulder, and I was afraid to reach for it. I was afraid they'd shoot me, and finally I said, no, they got down by me. Oh, yeah, okay, give it to him. What's funny, but they picked me up and took me to the hospital. But Raider meets the co-pilot. The co-pilot's father had married his French girl in World War One. He had grandparents in Paris. They stayed with him. And Ryan, my co-pilot, he was a very good friend of mine. When we went into London together, he and I, but he could speak French fluently, spoke some free French, and they were as astounded because he could speak such fluent French. But they finally escaped. They got with the underground, and they got a couple of times where they were pulled out of bars just in time for the Germans to strafe it. Then they got sent to put on an old fishing boat. And it was got pushed down in the bottom of it. It was stunk terribly. And the German officers came up, and they were going to go down and find him. And the German officer was going to come down, and it was stunk so bad. He said, "Ah, no, good." They got back to England on that fishing boat. Normally, they go down through Spain. That's the only time I ever heard of that. Anyway, that happened.
And that would have been your outcome too, if you weren't hurt so badly, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I'd have been out of there.
So what happened to you from there?
And I went into this hospital in Paris, and I was there, Hôpital Beaujon, which is a big, tall, nine. We were on the ninth floor, right on the Seine River, and I had a whole floor of prisoners. Yeah, and a German doctor put a steel pin in my leg, from the knee down, and where the break was. Instead of having my foot straight below it, he put a 20-degree bow in it. I came to the next day, and there was a 20-degree bow in my leg with a big cast on it. Well, it turns out that he did it on purpose. I got repatriated because of that. Yeah, Dr. Honecker.
Your initial reaction is that this guy just really messed me up, but he was actually doing you a favor.
Well, I think that later, because now I had a roommate of mine in the hospital, RAF lieutenant. That was this doctor did five breaks in his lower arm. Beautiful job. You could see the x-rays. They'd already taken his leg. So he was repatriated, but he had his arm good.
And this is, and for everybody listening, I want to set the timeline. This is August 16th of 1943 is when you got shot down.
Right.
So the war isn't going to end for almost 2 years from then.
Right.
So if you had been a POW that entire time, your experience would have been a little different.
Yeah, well, I was in Paris for, April, I'd say, and from August to April. And then two German guards took me to Germany, took two guards. I got a cast on, and they took the walker off, and I'm got RAF trousers from some big guy, and they were wrapped around, and it was funny. We're at the train station and waiting, and they took me into the bar and sat me down and bought a beer. The French were giving me V for victory. They could see my collar and stuff. And the German officer was sitting there with a real flashy gal sitting at the bar. And I mean, they had a table, and he was in I don't know what kind of a uniform, but it was really something. He got up and came over there and wanted to know what they were doing with this. The Germans didn't get excited at all. He just said, "Think of it." He went back and sat down. Anyway, that was that.
Well, I want to make sure I understand the impact of this. If that doctor had set your leg correctly, what do you think would have been different?
Well, I would probably end up going to an officer camp and POW camp, that's, like in the movies. Yeah, I'd probably end up going. But through all that time, I was sent from place to place. First, when I got back to Germany, I went to the Luftwaffe interrogation center at Frankfurt.
And how did that interrogation go?
Well, went into a little old room, 6x12, a small room with frosted glass windows and water jug and a string to pull if you wanted to go to the John. I know there was a guy next door, and we got talking and asked where he was from, and he said, OH-10. And I said, Oklahoma? There's no Oklahoma. I said, that's not right. OH-10? What the hell is OH? Oh, Ohio. Oh, God. Anyway, that's funny. And then the German officer came and interrogated me and told me who my CO was and what outfit I was in. And of course, I was old stuff by the time I got there, because it was 6 months, later. I didn't have any information they wanted.
You lived this, so it's not hard for you to describe it. It's just going back into your memory. But I'm trying to imagine myself in your shoes. You're hurt. You've got to be in pain. You don't know if you're ever going to get back to America. How did you keep hopeful and believe that you would make it home someday?
Well, the first 6 months or so is the worst. But then after that, you start getting used to it, and you see the Germans aren't going to shoot you. They're not like the Japanese. They treat us relatively good. The only people that treated you bad were like civilians if you got shot down in a town, women and stuff. And SS troops would get you there bad. But normally, if you got picked up by German soldiers, some guys didn't get it good, but a lot of them made it all right. It wasn't that bad. The only time I got scared is when we got attacked by bombers, or when we were in a train and they were going to be attacked by fighters and stuff.
American fighters, probably.
Yeah, American fighters. Yeah. I had a couple of situations where that happened.
What do you do in a situation like that?
Well, I was going to hit under in the train, I was going to hit under this bench, but there was a guy there ahead of me. When our fighters came through and were strafing, and we made it all right. We got into this big, this is on a train, where we ended up going to Switzerland eventually. But we were in this big marshalling yard. They took the engine away. We're sitting out there in the middle of it. And it's when our guys were bombing marshalling yards. We heard the distant area alarm. We heard the overhead area alarm. And that's when I was scared. A lot of us were, because we knew we were going to get bombed. We just knew they were going to bomb us. They flew right on over us and went on someplace else. Oh, my God, was great. I mean, that was great when they went on. Whew. Yeah, I'll never forget that, I guarantee you.
Yeah, that sounds like a really, really helpless feeling. So they kept moving you around. Give me the rest of that journey until you finally became free again.
Well, eventually then I was in a couple of places, barracks with guys. They didn't do anything. We were transferred from this place to that. I finally went to this ag school and college, and at that place we were getting ready to catch the train to go to Switzerland. That's when I first saw our first German jet. We looked up, flying over us, and some guy says, look at that guy go. He didn't have any props. First German jet.
The ME-262, huh?
262 is what it was. That's right.
And for us now, that's an everyday occurrence to hear the jets going overhead, but you didn't even know such a thing existed, right?
We had no idea that something, I had no idea. I didn't know what the hell it was.
And on a serious note, you ever stop and think what those could have done to your bomber crews?
If they just, Hitler, he held them off for a while before they built them. Yeah, it was his fault. We'd have been annihilated, I think. Yeah, that was, we were very fortunate in that war all the way. I'll tell you that. We were fortunate on the invasion. We were fortunate. You can do what you want to, but maybe God was on our side. I don't know. Of course, the Germans thought they were on his side. Well, they didn't think much of God, I guess.
I won't argue with your original interpretation, but tell us about your path to liberation, to truly experiencing freedom again and coming home.
And then we go all the way the length of Switzerland at night and went down to Geneva, I guess it is. Got off there, and then they took us on the train to Marseille. We got there and put us on a little yacht, kind of a ship, a small ship, American ship, waiting for the Gripsholm, the Navy, a Swedish ship, to come and pick us up, to bring us home. And so we were on the little ship for a while, and then Gripsholm came and put us on, and we came home. I'll never forget, it was me and Bert Shepherd. I don't know if you ever heard of Bert Shepherd. Bert Shepherd was a fighter pilot that got shot down and he lost his leg, and he wanted to be a baseball player. He was a baseball player, and the prisoners fixed him a leg, and he used to practice with it. He came home and pitched one inning for the Washington Senators. Yeah. Well, they couldn't use him. is, you know, the war was still on. We got home because we were repatriated.
Yeah, when was it that you got home?
Well, it was the end of January of 45.
And did you sail into New York City?
We were there for a while, yeah.
Well, the reason I ask is so many POWs have told me that after losing their freedom and experiencing life in another country as a prisoner, to see the Statue of Liberty again had special significance.
You better believe it did. And they had ships come out there spewing water and playing Don't Fence Me In. And, oh, we had a week when the Gripsholm came in. It was wild. I mean, they gave us a welcome. It was great.
You know, I'm thinking back to something you said earlier. You were talking about it seemed that God was on America's side in the war. And I hear your story, and I wonder if you felt God was on your side. You talk about your pilot being shot while he's falling in his parachute. They didn't shoot at you. And then this German doctor twists your leg, so you're going to get sent home instead of in a POW camp. I'm sure there are a lot of things like that, but does that make you feel like somebody was looking out for you?
Well, I've always thought there's somebody up there above. There's something, yeah. Sure. If you don't think that, there's something wrong with you. There's a higher authority, no doubt about it in my mind.
Is that a humbling thought, to think of how close things could have been different for you?
No, I never thought of it that way. Yeah, I'm not that deep. I'm shallow. I'm real shallow.
What did you say that German doctor's name was?
Honecker.
Yeah. You haven't forgotten that?
I don't know why. I've never forgotten his name, Honecker.
And if you saw him again, what would you say to him?
Oh, I don't know. I'd say thank you. I saw a couple of Germans that I was... At one time, if I'd have seen him on the street and had a gun, I would have very easily shot him.
When you think back on all your experiences, what would you say you're most thankful for, most proud of?
As I told you, I'm not very deep. I'm proud of my life. I've been honest. I haven't cheated anybody. I don't lie to people. I don't believe in it. And I haven't hurt anybody. I thought I did a pretty good job as a judge. I know I had some people that told me later I did. Some people wouldn't talk to me about it. Mm-hmm. I had a little different approach.
He had a POW's perspective, something maybe you and I can benefit from today. It's time for our final break, but when this special POW MIA Day episode continues, another World War II prisoner of war who came close to making the ultimate sacrifice, something his beloved son would do in the Vietnam War. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking National Prisoner of War and Missing in Action Recognition Day through the memories of two World War II prisoners of war. Pascual Reyes would spend 7 months in captivity after experiencing combat with the 36th Infantry Division in North Africa, Italy, and France.
They captured me because we were in two buildings. I was in one building and they were in the majority of the guys were in this big building. And then to the right was a forest, and to the back of them there was forest. And I told them, we're going to be down there. If you guys start going down, it's going to start raining, it's getting dark, dark. We'll engage the guys, the enemy. We'll engage them for a while, then we're going to start running back over there that way. About that time, this jeep comes in, And they were shooting all over, but they didn't get him. He was a captain. And we told him to get the hell out to the back, to run over to our forest. We started engaging the enemy. Well, of course, you know, just a little while, somebody in English, told us, "You Americans better give up now. You haven't got a chance. Plain English, good English." Then he talked to us in Spanish, and he told us, you know, that we didn't have a chance in Spanish. I said, "What the hell is this?" About that time, a big tank comes, stays over there. So what we did, we gave up. But the rest of the guys had taken off. They escaped, some of them, but some of them were still captured.
How many were there in the group that you were in that were captured there?
Oh, about 5 or 7, something like that.
But you knew you guys were outnumbered and surrounded.
Oh, yeah. With that tank, if we would have done a couple of shots, that tank would have blown us up. I wouldn't be here. So I told the guys, what's up to you? I'll leave it up to you. You want to keep on or you want to give up now? I said, there's no chance. Remember, that tank is up there. Said, we haven't got a chance.
Well, and before you got captured, you were wounded. What happened there? Tell me about it.
Well, what happened is that I got wounded, you know, I don't know if it was a bullet or a piece of that stuff, but hit my butt. You know, most of the time you get hit in the butt, and I did. I couldn't walk very much. I couldn't run that much. Then they wanted me to carry a German when I got captured because I couldn't move very much.
Because you got captured not long after you were wounded, so your left side is still in a lot of pain?
Yeah. They got me real bad, you know, and I couldn't move. I didn't want to shoot because, I couldn't move. I knew that if I shot, I was going to be killed because I couldn't run and hide behind the trees and all that. So like the German said, just throw your rifle out, it'll be clear.
Well, maybe you can walk us through what it was like from there, because I'm sure you had no idea what to expect when you're going to be a prisoner.
I didn't expect nothing. I knew that I was captured. I didn't know if I was going to be killed because they told us, you know, that be careful because some of these Germans are very handy with their rifles or pistols. And they don't care. They'll knock the hell out of you. But they captured me and they took me to a barn because it started raining. Some of us, they didn't keep us together because we were quite a bit of us, about 200, I think. They had a lot of hay and some of these Germans were resting inside the barn. Why fight it? There's nothing for me to do right now. I went to sleep. In the morning, they marched us to this place, prison place. Before they did that, they interviewed us and all that. He was a mean little guy. You know, all we said were like, everybody, your name, rank, and serial number. And we stuck with it. And we stuck with it, period. They wanted to know how many divisions or what company and all that. We didn't say nothing. Slapped the hell out of us.
Wait, I want to make sure people hear that. You said they slapped you.
Oh, yes. They slapped us a couple of times. They did that because they were trying to hurt us, to scare us. See, we would talk, see? I knew that. So they sent me to a prison camp where I met the rest of the guys, and they were aviators. And they I talked with this young aviator, and he told me, he said, I was wounded, and my plane came down, and I got hurt. But they took care of me here in the hospital. You'd be imagined, doctors there, German doctors, good doctors that took care of the people. Anyway, we were in that camp, and the nurses would come around in the car, and they would go through the camp. Check everybody out, make everybody stand out. Then they would send out the dogs in there to all the buildings. They were looking for a radio. These guys, these engineers, we picked up what they told us to pick, and they made a radio. And they had it there and right in the kitchen. There was a post there, a wooden post. And I don't know, this guy was very smart. How he dug a little thing, and they had that thing in there.
He hollowed out part of the post to hide the radio inside?
Yeah.
And the Germans never found it?
Never found it.
That was your connection to the outside world.
Yeah, we used to hear British broadcasting, and they would tell us exactly how far our people were. So we were just taking it easy in prison. We didn't do nothing to arise the Germans. That's the way we kept it until the people came in, you know.
One of the methods of transportation he had experienced was the infamous 40-8 boxcar, big enough for 40 men or 8 horses. But how many prisoners you think you had packed in there?
Oh, I don't know, because he was full. I mean, he was full. And guys were sick and wounded and whatever, you know. So I got up to the corner of the cart so I could breathe in a little window that had a because most of those guys were sick, throwing up and all that. They were very in bad shape. And then our own planes came in, strafe us. The train stopped, you know, and they took us off. Our airplanes kept strafing us until they seen all the prisoners. Then they stopped. Then they put us back in the corner in a train. And then we kept going then to the prisons.
When those American planes were strafing, did they kill some of the prisoners?
I suppose so, yeah. I think they did. Yeah, because the train had a lot of prisoners. I'm pretty sure that some of them got hurt in the back. There was a tunnel. We were close to that. Some of us got in there.
You went and hid in the train tunnel?
Yeah, we got in the tunnel, and our guards too. But this place came around a couple of times, strafing back and forth until they found out, I guess, that they had to lay off, you know. We were prisoners.
What was the hardest thing for you about being a prisoner?
The hardest thing for me to be a prisoner was that I was a prisoner in the first place and I couldn't move. I escaped twice from my work detail, but I didn't know which way to go. So I got into the work detail, going back. Somebody told me which way to go. But then when I went out again from this work detail, this Puerto Rican went with me. I didn't care for it, and nobody to go with me. And this Puerto Rican, he was in a tree, and this kid seen him. And this so stupid killed the kid. But by that time, I swung out of there and went back straight off and went into the work detail. And I was scared then because they were all police and those Germans were all over. They found this guy. They killed him. Oh, I said, no, I ain't going to go out no more. I'm liable to get caught and killed, you know.
So you had been out on a work detail and snuck off by yourself? You're all alone?
Yeah.
But because you didn't know which way to go, when you saw that crew again, you joined back up?
Yeah, I went back. They told me which way to go if I wanted to leave. I said, no, I'm not going to leave no more. You know, I'm not going to take no chances like that. Because they get me, I'll be shot right there.
And you knew that because you saw that happen to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Was there a time where your family didn't know what had happened to you?
Yes. When I got captured, they didn't know for a long time that I had been captured already.
So they probably thought you were dead.
Yeah. The Red Cross let him know. They went over there to the house and let him know that I had been captured.
So while you were in captivity, which was quite a while, if you look at late September to end of April, a little more than 7 months?
Something like that.
That's a long time when you don't know when it's going to end, right? How did you pass the time? How did you remain hopeful in the midst of that kind of situation?
You wouldn't believe it, but I did exercises. This guy and me would shadow box against a wall and do exercise in place, you know. And all the time, every day we did run push-ups. And that's the way I kept busy.
Did you ever have days where you thought, I might not ever get out of here?
Yes. You're there, you know, and you never know what the Germans could do. If they started losing, I figured that they would shoot us, you know, like they shot the rest of some of those guys. We didn't know, you know, for sure what these Germans would do, you know. If they would get revenge or before they would be captured, I figured they would shoot us. And then with those little machine guns, you couldn't escape. I told myself, if there's rifles, I'll take a chance and run the heck out of me. But machine guns, no. No way.
So while you were in the prison camp, you had another bout of malaria?
Yes. I got another heavy malaria. I was sick. I thought I was going to die because I had been, you know, the food wasn't that good. And then you're weak, very weak. There were some British soldiers there, and they kept me going, wetting my lips and giving me a little water because I would get sick if I drink a lot of it, just a little bit. And I would feel okay. And I don't know where the hell they found out those Erbine pills or whatever you call them, those yellow pills, and they gave me some. The malaria started easing off. After that, they gave me another two pills, and before I know it, I didn't have no more malaria. And I could drink a little bit more water. That's the way I went, with a little bit more water every day. That's the way I went until I got Patton came in.
Those fellow prisoners of yours, those British guys, they really did save your life.
Yeah, they did. You know, I looked for their names. I wanted to know their names, and I could never find them. Never. I was in Europe one day, you know, and I was in a train, and I was telling these people. He says, that little town, that village is close to us. Do you know their name? We'll take them for you. But they never did, of course, you know. But they saved my life. They gave me those pills. Those headaches went away. See, you get the chills. and you get a headache. You get those headaches very heavy. Then you get really, really hot. I mean, your body can't stand that.
Have you ever had any recurrences of that in the years since the war?
Only one time when I came back after the service at my house. I was sitting down, and all of a sudden, I started going like that.
You mentioned until Patton came in, and there's
famous
photographs of Patton in his Jeep coming through the gate at Mooseburg, Stalag 7A. His son-in-law, I think, had been a prisoner there. But what was that like for you, that experience of having months and months of being a prisoner, not knowing freedom, and then to have these Americans, including one of the most famous Americans in the war, come and set you free? Tell me about what that time was like.
There was that thing, the General Patton coming in. You know, he's a rough and a bad mouth, everybody. You know. Oh, man, you seen him like... He was the greatest in this world. He said, I would say he was my angel, my guardian angel. And the guy came through that camp, and he said, bring out all those Germans out of here, because the Germans were hiding, you know. They had to come out, all of them. Boy, he went around and cussed the hell out of them, and he said, you know, he was going to kill each and every one of them. You know, he said he was bad mouth, you know. He got in his Jeep again, you know. Here we go. But I was so, so happy, like something had been lifted off my shoulders. That man was tough, but he was a gentle giant. He was what you call a man, a general. They took us to the airport there, close by. There was an airport, you know, it was hidden, you know. You couldn't see it, but it was there. And the American transport planes came around. Boy, they were good flyers. They'd come around the field, one by one, then another turn. All the planes lined up. Then they took us. They gave us a ride all the way to France. They took us up to the doctors. They had a big building. They had a physical, a shower, a haircut. And I mean that they went through everything in our body. Like I said, they gave us a haircut and a bath, new clothes. Man, I felt like I was a king there. We were back with our people, and they treated us like taps. Then they sent us into the hospital boats, you know, the ones that were going to bring us back. The same thing with those sailors. They had Marines in there and sailors, and they treated us taps. Man, it was good. Good meals all the way, all the steaks you wanted, whatever. But we couldn't eat very much steak. On account of stomach. Yeah, we had those shrunken stomach. You had to eat in one line chocolate, all the chocolate you could drink, and eggnog, and that's all. After so many days, they would change you to another line where you could eat a little bit more, a little more heavy. Then you got into a steak line. That was good. When you hit that steak line, that was for it. That was forever.
What was it like to get back to America again after you were a prisoner for so long?
When I see the Liberty, of Station of Liberty, I cried. I actually cried. Not only me, the rest of the guys.
He would experience tears of a deeper depth decades later when his son Ronnie, a 19-year-old Marine, was killed in action in Vietnam. Those 58,000 names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall always held incredible meaning for Pascual Reyes.
And I want people to know that those names is a human being that was in this world years back. They're gone, but for a reason, for freedom, for the freedom they want, and for the freedom they have, all everybody. That's what I want them to know.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for your service to our country and for the price that you helped pay for that freedom. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, like I said, my son, I want him to, the people to know why those names are there, because they gave their life for the freedom we have today, not just because they went and fought a war. That's the freedom you have, the freedom we all have, and they shouldn't forget them. They should honor them as much as they can. That's why.
I told you our perspective might be a little different. By the end of the program, we heard from two ex-prisoners of war who are no longer with us in 2023 as we mark National POW MIA Recognition Day, but whose stories can help shape the way we face every day. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.